All right, I'm with Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to Device Talks Weekly. We're closing in on Device Talks West, and I'm here with Kayleen Brown, our fantastic Device Talks Managing Editor. Kayleen, it's here.
I know. I'm so excited. I'm also completely nervous, and my hair's on fire, and I'm shaking a little bit, but it's all the great pre-conference shakes. I am excited to be on stage. You know how much I love that. I'm excited to be behind the camera. And to those points, I have been so busy, Tom, so busy trying to put together the discussion leaders for the Women in MedTech Breakfast. As a reminder for that, once we finish the conversation with Intuitive's Darla Hutton, which is on the power of global representation, we're going to break out into breakout sessions, and each table will be hosted by a discussion leader who I invite from industry, who has a great perspective, to continue that conversation and help those who maybe would not be so inclined to go into the spotlight to be heard, and those like me who won't stop talking to listen more. So working on the discussion leaders, and then we're recording our FOMO interviews, Future of MedTech Opportunities, live. So just working on that schedule, getting all of the interviews in line so that we have a full 2 days of live interviews on stage, behind the camera. Oof, my favorite things. What are you up to?
Oh, well, you know, I'm getting ready for our keynote interviews. We have a lot of great keynotes that I've talked about. We'll be opening up with Tim Schmidt of Johnson & Johnson MedTech and Ray Cohen and Anna Zdois of Moon Surgical. You'll be interviewing Josh Macauer of Stanford. Lots going on there. Folks should just go to west.devicetalks.com to get details on the agenda. A few housekeeping notes about the Women in MedTech Breakfast. If you have not registered yet, as you're registering at west.devicetalks.com, make sure you check the box that says you'd like to attend the Women in MedTech Breakfast. We need you to do that separate action there. And if you have already registered and you did not do that, please reach out, or actually you can update your registration to make sure you're able to attend. There's a limited number of seats there, and we want to make sure folks who want to be there are there. And Kayleen, who do we want to be in that room?
Everyone. If you love MedTech and you believe in this beautiful industry, there is a seat with your name on it. You don't have to be a woman. You just have to be an ally. So please, all welcome.
And it's a wonderful way to start day two. Sometimes day twos of conferences need a little oomph. And this is definitely that. So I do recommend that that everyone who is registering, try to get in. As I said, seats are limited, but there still are some available. So do not sleep on that. The FOMOs will be a ton of fun. We'll be doing those out in the open so folks can watch us at our quote-unquote craft. And the rest of the day is just going to be great meetings in our conference space and great opportunities to build your MedTech team on our exhibit floor. We could not do this without our great sponsors, and we're looking forward to seeing each and every one of them at Device Talks West. So if you're interested in joining us, and I don't know why you would not be, and if you missed out on AdvaMed, which was a fantastic experience this week, and you need a conference of your very own, that is us. You go to west.devicetalks.com to register for Device Talks West, again, October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. Kayleen, have I missed anything? I feel like I've gotten it all out there.
Oh, you know me, I'm gushy. So the one thing I would just say is, again, thank you. Thank you so much to our sponsors. Thank you, Tom, for giving me the opportunity to have the best job in the world. And thank you so much to our Device Talkers for reminding us that in our own way, in our small way, we are making a meaningful difference. And thank you for all you do as well.
That's well said. As I was at AdvaMed, and I was taken aback by the number of people who really appreciate what we're trying to do here at Device Talks, and I could not do it, Kayleen Brown, without your help. This would be an impossible task. So thank you for your support all the way through with everything we do, and we can't wait to see everybody at Device Talks West. Again, go to west.devicetalks.com to register. All right, let us get this podcast started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Chris Newmarker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well. Busy week. We got a lot of irons in the fire. A lot of stuff going on. So
yes, sir. We'll be at Device Talks West next week. You and I and our entire, well, most of our Mass Device MDO team. We'll have managing editor of Device Talks, Kayleen Brown, and managing editor of Metal Design Outsourcing, Jim Hammerin. You and me, and we'll be talking to a lot of real interesting people.
Man, the lineup for the show next week. I mean, you and Kayleen have outdone yourself, like lining up all of this. I mean, I'm fortunate that I have helped, but I mean, my gosh, it's really outstanding. I mean, this is definitely one of. I mean, people should go to every Device Talks, but this is like one they definitely need to go to.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy about it. I went, probably already reviewed the keynotes at the top of the podcast and everything else. But no, it's an amazing collection of people. I think tackling a lot of interesting things. Sean Hooley and I, of course, senior editor Sean Hooley and I were at AdvaMed this week, the MedTech conference.
It was a big deal.
Yeah, but I think I was talking with David Nolwani from NVIDIA there, and he'll be at Device Talks West and RoboBusiness also next week. And he made a good point. He's like, the MedTech conference was great for sort of discussion of big ideas and meeting with sort of the senior folks. Then the following week, you get to go to Device Talks and really talk with the folks who are doing the work and making the devices. So it's a way to bring the insights from the mountaintop, so to speak, down to the floor where things are happening. So
yeah, the people doing the tech and the innovation and building the things, and you know, and I mean, just this, the amount of networking, you know, going on at that show is just fantastic.
Yeah, no, it'll be a great 2 days, and we've got a great episode today because it's kind of a little preview of a couple of the speakers we'll be having at Device Talks West. I'll talk with Sarah Matt. The keynote conversation will be Dr. Steven Michelson, who, of course, founded Farapulse.
And yeah, that company did something, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that guy.
Oh, my gosh.
I'll just say, he's CEO of Field Medical, and he'll be presenting the future of PFA at Device Talks West, a conversation I know you'll be leading.
Yeah.
Chris, we got a good job, you and me. We got a good gig, you know that?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I mean, talk to people who just like are doing like this kind of outstanding work. And I mean, and I was, you know, catching up with Dr. Michelson just last Friday.
Yeah.
And we're recording this on Thursday, you know, just to, you know, prepare for, you know, the interview at this show. And I mean, yeah, he's got Field Medical, like pulse field ablation, you know, the initial indications to treat VT. Then Dell, you know, he's also like, you know, founded Dell MedTech, you know, they're looking to not innovative non-cardiac therapy in the, you know, that non-cardiac therapy space using PFA technology. And then he's also got Attraverse Medical, which is dedicated to find, you know, a next generation tool set for left heart access. I mean, of course, like Farapulse, you know, Boston Scientific acquired Baylis to get, you know, left heart access, but now they're, you know, like, you know, this new venture that, you know, that Dr. Michelson's involved with is looking to like do something next gen in that left heart access area. But I mean, just talking to him, I'm really feeling like that interview that we're going to be doing next week is going to be, I think it's going to be like a masterclass in how to like up your game as an entrepreneur, like not just be an entrepreneur, but an entrepreneur who is starting like multiple companies at the same time and is becoming kind of this innovation powerhouse. I mean, there's a few other names I can think of in our industry that have been like that. Like, I mean, Bob Langer does off the top of my head.
Yeah, but, I mean, and you know, Tom Fogarty is a legend, of course, and we want to make comparisons. But Dr. Michelson just strikes me as one of these people who, by the time you and I are done covering this industry, he will be connected to. I wouldn't be surprised if it's like five or six notable med tech companies.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I definitely get those kinds of vibes, and nice too that he has roots in Duluth, Minnesota.
I forgot about that. Yes, that's right.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So you'll have the chance to talk to him then, but folks listening to this podcast will have the chance as well. I mean, every session we build is like, you have an hour in the room, we'll talk for about 40, 45 minutes, and then the 15 minutes is up for you guys. Go talk to them, ask your questions. I've talked before about how accessible our speakers are. So I really do hope folks will join us at Device Talks West for your conversation, for all the other great conversations. Jim's going to be leading a great cardiac innovations panel. Kayleen will be doing keynotes with Josh Macauer. And I'll be talking with Anna Swabit again. You can go to west.devicetalks.com. Ray Cohen. So much going on. So much going on.
Yep. I mean, we got that that panel, I think, near the end of the show, right? Like on telesurgery, you know, using robotics. That's just a great line of people from Intuitive, Virtual Incision.
Yeah, we'll have Brian Miller from Intuitive. Yeah. We'll have Shane Faritor from Virtual Incision. We'll have Yulan Wang from Savato and Mustafa Tuli from NVIDIA and Mike Kajewski from MedCrypt. So,
and they have all been co-authors of technical guidelines that came out this year for robotic telesurgery.
They wrote the rules, basically.
Yeah, these are the people who wrote the rule. Exactly.
They weren't the only ones. A lot of great ones from like Martin Mueller from J&J was another one. But we can only fit so many people up on stage. So they were amongst the folks who wrote the rules. So
that's going to be a great talk.
I mean, go right to the source. And then I'll wrap it all up with a conversation and presentation by Aman Jetty of Intuitive. She leads both the single port and the multi-port platforms at Intuitive. And she'll give an overview of the future of surgical robotics and then sit down with me for a short conversation. So
that's great.
Can't wait. Absolutely can't wait. I just got back this morning from California, and I can't wait to get back because Device Talks West is going to be fantastic. So
sounds like you should just keep on sleeping like you're on California time.
You know what? I'm going to. That's a great point. I woke up this morning at 8 o'clock, and I'm like, you know what? I think I'm just going to, my kid doesn't have school tomorrow, so I have to drive him in. I'm just going to keep this schedule because that's great minds. Great minds, Chris Newmarker.
Keep that time rhythm going.
We're always looking for the hacks. I'll be going to bed at 2 a.m. Eastern time just to keep my time on Western time. So
there you go. Find a few good TV series to binge the next few days. This is your chance, Tom. It's like if you've always been like, you know, I never watched Breaking Bad, and you know, I should really like finally see what was up with that, like chemistry teacher becomes, you know, starts making meth. Yeah, I'm gonna figure it out now, you know. I
mean, no spoilers. No, yeah. I already have seen
that was at the beginning of the series. I mean, come on.
All right,
anyway, be great.
Well, you and I are blessed individuals, Chris Newmarker. We've got a great gig, and we want to share our insights and connections with you all at Device Talks West on October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. Go to west.devicetalks.com. And if you need further convincing, message Chris on LinkedIn, reach out to me.
Yeah.
And we'll take care of you. We'll make sure you've got everything you need to get there. So
we'd
love to have you in the rooms at the Santa Clara Convention Center.
Love to see as many of you as possible there. It would be fantastic.
Well, keeping on our preview of Device Talks West, which again is happening on October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center, go to west.devicetalks.com to register. We have our FOMO with Dr. Sarah Matt, who is the author of a book that's coming out in December, The Borderless Healthcare Revolution. She's got an amazing background, and she's on an amazing panel called Smarter Devices, Better Outcomes, How Connectivity is Transforming Patient Care. And when I put this one together, I really wanted multiple perspectives. So we've got an addition to Sarah Matt, whose book, The Borderless Healthcare Revolution, is coming out, and who is a practicing doctor and who has worked at Oracle. And she'll get into all of that in the interview, into the FOMO interview. We also have Dr. Oliver Keown, who is a CEO at Oath Surgical, which is a really tech-forward ambulatory surgery center business that Oliver started a few years ago. Oliver had previously been at Intuitive Ventures. He was on our Intuitive Talks podcast when he did that. Now he's moving into this tech services space. So you can catch Oliver at Device Talks West, along with Sarah and along with Janja Pathak, who is the Medical Science Manager of Medical Affairs at Abbott's Neuromodulation Business. So we've got MedTech. We've got MedTech/services, and we have Tech/Medical. And all of that is going to be tied together by our moderator, Bill Benton, who's the Director of MedTech Solutions at S3 Connected Health. So again, I really, when we put this agenda together and we put this panel together, I wanted to do something other than just have three connected health companies up there talking about how they're going about things. I really wanted to unpack what's happening in the real world. So it's going to be a great panel, and a huge part of that greatness will be Dr. Sarah Matt. So let's start my interview with Dr. Sarah Matt, again, author of The Borderless Healthcare Revolution. Well, Dr. Sarah Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Thomas. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you as well. You were a guest of ours at Device Talks Boston, and happy to have you next week or this week, depending upon when people are listening to Device Talks West. You'll be on our Connected Health panel, which I think I'm really excited about, because I think it really is sort of going forth. We're past the point of, oh, isn't Connected Health neat and important, into like, oh my God, how are we going to do this? So,
exactly.
And I think you're the perfect person to address this. So you do have a book coming out on December 11th called The Borderless Healthcare Revolution. I ask you this question with all due respect. What makes you an expert in this conversation? What's your background? Because it is really compelling.
I love that, Tom. Thank you. So I'm a surgeon by training, but I changed my career into the tech side very early in my career for impact. And so for me, bedside care was very constraining. You can only see maybe 20 patients a day at best as a surgeon. But now on the tech side, for my whole career, I can impact hundreds, thousands, millions, and billions of people every day. So I've been building product and development teams all over the world for my entire career. Everything from the digital health side, so next-gen healthcare, EMRs, et cetera, to several different startups. And I was at Oracle Health for a long time. I started there in OCI, building out their healthcare and life science business for cloud globally before helping them acquire Cerner. And so I've been at the Series A side, and I've been at the hyperscale side, everything from applications down to platform infrastructure. And then you may have seen me in Boston this past spring as Chief Strategy Officer at Savato, so enabling remote robotic surgery. And so for me, it's about not just delivery in device, med tech, et cetera, but in building. And so that's where I come in, because my expertise is not just clinical. I just saw patients this morning, but it's also in building those solutions, not just for gain in terms of revenue, but gains in terms of scalability and gains in terms of impact to patients.
So you're walking between these two worlds, healthcare and tech, and doing so comfortably. So how different are these two groups? Are we seeing differences that aren't there? Is the they part of the conversation overstated, or are there really sort of two vastly different understandings of what the problems are and what the solutions are?
I think there are. So as I was writing my book, I actually aimed the book at two different audiences for this exact same reason. So leaders in healthcare delivery and builders in health tech device and med tech have very different incentives. So we have folks that are dealing with patients every day, have to deal with reimbursement and collecting on it every day, and not necessarily having to innovate, create new, go through FDA, et cetera. Whereas on the building side, we have all sorts of regulatory impacts. We have to deal with the FDA and other regulatory bodies, but we also have to deal with immense competition within the United States and abroad, and the speed of tech and the speed of getting it into the hands of those who can use it. And so again, different incentives and different speeds of business.
So I had given my my sort of layperson's assessment of where we are in this transformation and move toward connected health. Give us a better, more precise GPS location as to where we are. Are we just beginning to arrive, or are we arriving at the exit off the off? Like, where are we in really achieving the potential of what technology can do in healthcare?
So I think at this point, we're still dabbling in a lot of ways. And it's not because the tech isn't there. The tech is there. The tech will continue to move forward. We are ramping and accelerating the, I'd say, pace of innovation, utilizing AI, utilizing new technologies, new materials, et cetera, so fast. The technology is the easy part. Mm-hmm. The hard part is adoption, implementation, policy building. How is this actually going to work in a workflow with real human beings? How is it going to actually be considered safe by providers, considered safe by patients? So what I'd say is that the tech is there. Uh-huh. That's not the issue. It's everything else That's the hard part. Mostly the trust.
Great point. So the panel you'll be on at Device Talks West will have someone from the CEO of Oath Surgical, we'll have someone from Abbott, so we'll have sort of clinical setting. We'll have a medical device company. We'll have Bill Betton, who's been in the device industry for decades, and yourself. So I'm really happy with the different forces we're bringing together. What would you, I'm sure this will come up at the meeting, what advice would you give to medical device companies? We could say startups or OEMs, either one. What are they missing? What do you think they'll glean, if not from that conversation, although I hope they do, from a conversation from you later on when they ask you, like, what am I doing wrong and what can I do right?
So I do a lot of startup advising and advising at larger levels. And I feel like I say the same thing every time. And unfortunately, it's consider your commercialization process when you're building your business case. It's not a bolt-on. Mm-hmm. Consider patient access from the beginning. It's not just a bolt-on. And the reason I say that is that we have to remember that providing whatever technology and solution that we are creating into the hands of delivery systems and those who are actually going to be impacted by it is, again, all about those things: trust, reimbursement, mm-hmm. the ability to get the right populations and demographics into your first study, all the different pieces there. So even though you've created an amazing technology, how is it actually going to work in the real world? How is it going to be taken into an operating room? How is it going to be able to be utilized in an actual person's life if it's a device they're going to be wearing every day? How is it going to work in the real world? So I think we have a lot of very, we'll call them sterilized experiments and mm-hmm. prototypes. But when we think about real world and the challenges of day-to-day life, I think we forget about some of the messiness that is healthcare and some of the messiness that it is to be human.
Who is the more important constituent in this? Is it the provider or is it the patient? Can you win market share by getting patients on your side, or do you need to get the providers on there first and then the patients will come?
So it depends on the device, absolutely, mm-hmm. especially in med tech or the therapeutic, if we're talking about pharma or devices as therapeutics. But let's just remember a couple things from a messaging perspective. If I am building a brand, whether it's for soft tissue robots or digital therapeutics or whatnot, I have to make sure that message, including the messages needed for trust, can get to the providers and then get to the patients if mm-hmm. I'm going to go in that direction. Doctors are not marketers and messengers.
No.
That's not what they're trained to do. And so you have to really think about, how can I build the trust within providers, understanding how they message? And is that the best way for me to do it? Or should I go the other direction, direct to consumer? And our consumers are our clients, are our patients. And therefore, can we message better to them? And it should go the other direction. So I think in today's day and age, our consumer patients are requiring and requesting more information. And they're also wanting more choices in what they can do. And the providers are still in a delivery system where there's huge legal stakes, where there's huge stakeholder management that they're doing too. And they may not have time to message your device or message your solution if they're not 100% convinced of it. So I think it's actually going to be a dual approach because mm-hmm. providers need to be convinced that it's safe, effective, et cetera, no matter what. But sometimes you need the consumer to even know about it so they can ask.
Final question. And again, the book is The Borderless Healthcare Revolution, The Definitive Guide to Breaking Geographic Barriers Through Technology. Do you have a vision of what this airplane that we're building in mid-flight looks like? I mean, do you see a there, or is that vision changing as technology evolves and it's going to be what it's going to be? And maybe it's probably never done, but do you have a vision of where we're headed and what things might look like?
So I think that with the pace of what we're doing today, whatever I could imagine that's a year from now, it's going to be completely different. Mm-hmm. If we're thinking past 6 months, I think we're probably doing something wrong. But what I would say is that if we continue to keep the patient at the center, and I know that's been used as a marketing term and weaponized, mm-hmm. but when I think about healthcare access, you know, what I lay out as the five pillars of access, which I kind of break into geography, financial, trust and knowledge, digital and cultural, if we consider all those aspects for the patient, for the hospital system, for the system at large, for the country we're working in, we're going to be considering all the different pieces. It's a system level view. So anyone who's in systems engineering, anyone who's doing big strategy, if you're considering just this little slice, you're not going to succeed. But if we're really considering the entire ecosystem and the stakeholders involved, I think that's where we're going to be the most successful, especially in a world that is moving so fast and where we're going to have to pivot really hard all the time.
That's fantastic. It's going to be such a great panel. Thank you for being part of Device Talks West. And again, folks can find the book on Amazon, The Borderless Healthcare Revolution, The Definitive Guide to Breaking Geographic Barriers Through Technology. I think you can pre-order it now. I see that. So
you absolutely can.
Sarah, Matt, thank you so much for joining us on FOMO.
Thanks, Tom.
All right. Once again, you can meet Sarah, Matt at Device Talks West. Now let's hear a message from our sponsor, Viant.
Anthony Meissner, General Manager for Design and Development for Viant. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Kayleen.
So Anthony, as I hear it, you just recently joined Viant. I think it was 3 months ago now.
Yeah, about that long.
So why Viant?
Viant was a really exciting opportunity for me. When I interviewed, when I met everybody, both on the leadership team and with the teams that I was going to be working with, I just saw this incredible sense of collaboration, teamwork, and energy around excitement to deliver medtech. So it was kind of a no-brainer to jump into that. And most of us in this industry, and I could see that on the faces of everybody that I met here, you know, they really were living up to that, you know, that tagline, you know, that we're in it for life. It's this partnership, this long-term partnership, and this commitment to patients that are saying, hey, I want to be a part of making new medical miracles happen.
I can see your passion, and we equally love Viant here at Device Talk. So for our audience who maybe isn't quite as familiar with Viant's capabilities and how they work with medical technology companies, can you share more about Viant?
Yeah, absolutely. So Viant's a global medical device design and manufacturing group. They've got 26 facilities worldwide dedicated to helping innovators bring life-changing tech to the market faster. We provide end-to-end solutions from early design and development through full-scale manufacturing. And we hit a lot of really interesting and exciting, to me, clinical markets. So breakthroughs, for example, in energy delivery, like intravascular lithotripsy, neuromodulation, renal denervation are transforming many of these exciting interventional industries. And OEM success in these spaces really depend on a true partner that can develop and manufacture and really excels at rapid iteration. And that's really where Viant comes in. So ultimately, Viant is more than, you know, a contract manufacturer. We're really aiming to be that strategic partner for the next wave of medtech innovation.
We'll hear more from this episode's sponsor, Viant, a little later on in the podcast. But if you want to know why Viant is in it for life, please visit viantmedical.com. That's V-I-A-N-T medical.com. And now we bring you our interview with Dr. Stephen Michelson, CEO of Field Medical.
Thank you, Kayleen Brown. Before we start this interview with Dr. Stephen Michelson of Field Medical, I did want to let you know that I talked to Stephen prior to the launch of Dell MedTech, which came out in September. He and I talked in late August. So we didn't talk about Dell MedTech. We talked a lot about field ablation and a lot about pulse field ablation, a lot about a success at FirePulse. So we won't get into Dell MedTech. We'll have to save that for the next podcast because this guy, he's got some stories ahead, I'm sure. So very happy to have Dr. Stephen Michelson at Device Talks West. Really excited about his discussion as well. Chris Newmarker alluded to it in earlier in the podcast. So once again, join us. Go to west.devicetalks.com to register. Use the code DTWeekly25 to save 25%. And now let's get this interview going. Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Michelson. He's the CEO of Field Medical. Well, Dr. Stephen Michelson, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. Excited to visit with you. You've got one of my favorite How I Got Into MedTech stories. I encourage people to check out our first podcast we did a few years ago where you told your whole story, and I'll recap it quickly so you don't need to go through it again. But you were amazingly a high school dropout, pursued a musical career, got a job in a hospital to pay the bills, and at some point just loved the day job more than the night job, got into the cath lab, and then started working with Dr. Fred Kuzumoto, and the rest is sort of history. I summed up a lot of years in there, I know.
Yeah, yeah. I decided to go back to college, it was largely due to Fred being like an amazing mentor at the time, you know, and being a partner in the journey. And you know, the decision to go to college at the age of 28, after being a high school dropout, was, you know, a big step. Took 18 years, and then I started working in EP, and I got to be an EP doctor, and so that was a heck of a lot of fun and a long journey.
What impact do you think that gap decade had on your career in terms of starting companies and being entrepreneurial?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a really good question. When I think about it, you know, the reality was, at the time, I didn't think of the music career as being a business. Mm-hmm. I thought of it, oh, I want to be an artist, I want to do great music, I want to record albums. And, you know, we got signed and we were touring and all that stuff, but I was managing it. I was making sure that we were promoting and getting into contracts and all that stuff and organizing. And I think those experiences really drove my comfort with the idea of, oh yeah, if you want to get something done, you just do it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think, you know, like how much of that was really business experience, but in the end, you know, it's, you know, a band is an entrepreneurial activity.
Very much so. You're right. And the bands, just so folks who know, the Bellyachers and Venus Diablo.
Yeah.
And you can actually catch them both. I found, I think CDs for both of them on eBay. So folks need to check it out. They can still track some down. So
yeah, there's a few. I mean, does anyone even have a CD player?
I know, anymore? Right?
I don't know. It's like
let's back up a bit on the Farapulse story. What led you to identify that energy source as I guess we can say people are seeing it as a superior way of treating atrial fibrillation. And how does that lead into your creating one of the founding companies in the space, if not the founding company?
Yeah, you know, so it was quite natural. At the time, you know, because I was a technician, when I worked with Fred, I had attended a number of what were called NASPE meetings, North American Society of Pacing Electrophysiology, mm-hmm. Which is now called Heart Rhythm Society.
Okay.
They changed the name because NASPE was a bacchanalia. It was crazy parties of a bunch of nerdy doctors really getting in trouble. And, you know, they didn't want to be associated with that anymore. So they changed the name. But, you know, so I had a lot of experience in watching the evolution of the field of interventional cardiac electrophysiology. So I was aware of how the field started. I knew who Mel Scheinman was. I knew, how catheter ablation evolved into, empiric procedures such as, flutter ablation. You know, in the early 90s, flutter ablation was still something you might map and try to figure out, but eventually we all figured out it's just an empiric, you know, a CTI line would be good enough for the 90% of people. And, I watched Pierre and Hassegger give, their talks on, we can actually treat AFib with a catheter ablation. Mm-hmm. I saw those presentations, and, you know, so I watched the evolution of during my training, you know, so I wanted to be an electrophysiologist before I did undergrad. So I did undergrad and I was still active in the field. And when I got to fellowship training, you know, this is a decade of time has elapsed.
That's amazing.
You know, I was watching the evolution of AFib ablation from a very niche concept into something that people were practicing, but there are complications. And when you have, you know, and I was thinking, gosh, you know, if we could go back in time, you know, back to the 90s when I saw those lectures and reinvent the field, knowing what we know today, would we do it differently? Mm-hmm. Is this approach the right approach? Are the imaging tools we're using, the mapping? Is it good to use thermal ablation when you're getting the asymptomatic cerebral emboli? Is that the safest approach? Is there a better way to do it? And so I started kind of going down a list and writing off all the things that you might be able to do to reduce risk of stroke, reduce risk of injury to the phrenic nerve, the esophagus, all those things. And then I drew this table where I drew every way you could do soft tissue ablation: radiation, alcohol, freeze it, cook it with microwaves, lasers, diphtheria toxin, like all these weird ways you could do it. And on there, because largely because of my experience early on with someone like Fred Kuzumoto and knowing about the emergence of catheter ablation being a pulse field ablation, literally DC ablation, that's what it was. I put in DC ablation. And then I went through there and I pros and cons of each one of them. And in the end, it was pretty clear to me that, boy, you have all these amazing advantages. Why the hell did they give up on this? And I started doing some research on it, and I realized, you know, one of the main issues was tolerability. It's probably what drove everyone away, because they didn't understand how DC ablation worked and stuff. And so that's kind of what drove the initial plan. So we did an epicardial approach early on, and I got some crazy stories about the tolerance at the University of Iowa. And
what does tolerability mean? What is it? Help me understand. What is
it? They put up with me during.
But in terms of the energy delivery, what was the issue you think that really scared him away? What, by tolerability?
Yeah, so you know, so they I like talking about the history of PFA. What happened is, you know, the initial plan was you paralyze somebody and you do a defibrillation like you would when you cardiovert someone.
Okay.
But yeah, you just, instead of two paddles, one paddle is attached to the outside of the body and one paddle is connected to the catheter on the inside of the body.
Oh, okay.
And then you would fire it off and it would create a jump like a defibrillation. And so everyone thought that the way it worked was like an explosion that would cause barotrauma to the tissue, and that would be the mechanism of injury. But all the pathology that was done at the time did not actually bear that out. And so a lot of people were uncertain about the mechanism. And meanwhile, in order to practice this type of ablation, you know, you had to completely sedate and paralyze the patient. Now, we do that almost universally in the United States these days. Now, that's a whole different story. But at the time, it was very difficult to do that from a workflow and logistics point of view. And a very smart group of other investigators figured out, oh, shoot, you know, we could use one of these RF generators that they use for electrocautery in the OR, and we can just attach that to the catheter and get the same results. Mm-hmm. And so radio frequency did not require putting somebody under deep sedation and paralytics. And that, I think, really drove the adoption curve. And so by the early 90s, DC ablation was almost unheard of. No one was doing it. And, you know, very few people. There are a few people who continued to do it through the 90s. And I actually know a few of them by name. but overall, it was pretty rare to see, and rightfully so. You know, if it wasn't for radio frequency, I don't think widespread adoption of this whole technique, catheter-based, minimally invasive approach to ablation, just would not have emerged with the same level of adoption as it did through the early 90s. And so
you're looking at that list of technologies, of ways to perform this, and you're looking for a new way, and you identify the electroablation. There must have been voices in your head. Well, this has already been checked out. Someone already figured out why. Like,
yeah.
How do you silence that? Because it would be very easy just to figure out these are a lot of smart people looking at this. Like, I can't be the only person seeing this.
Yeah. So I didn't pursue it initially because I thought I could make a company and make millions of dollars on a deal. I was trying to improve the procedure itself. Mm-hmm. And so I wasn't so worried about whether or not someone had done it in the past. I just said, what I'm looking for is what is the best way to do it.
But more why, I guess the question, like, you must have been thinking someone chose not to do this in the past. You had that voice saying, you know, someone else has checked this out. There's a lot of people who have looked at this space. I must be missing something. How do you look past that doubt and say, well, maybe I'm seeing something that just no one else has?
Well, that, you know, that's a great question. I wish I had a more elegant answer, but I'm going to tell you the truth. At the time, it didn't occur to me at all. I pursued it. The time it and the person who brought that question to my attention was Tim Lasky at Medtronic.
Oh, really?
When I first showed him the early results of you know, what would become FARAPULSE and stuff, he says, "Well, if that thing's so great, then why the hell did they abandon in the 1980s?" And I kind of had to like cogitate on that a little bit because, you know, again, I was looking at it from the role of the foundation of the energy and all those things, and you know, the idea that sedation and paralytics would be such a high obstacle to overcome, especially given the fact that so many procedures in the United States that are done for interventional electrophysiology are done with general anesthesia. So you'd, and paralytics have become common for mapping system stability. That, you know, it didn't immediately occur to me that, oh, why did they give it up? And it was brought to me by, you know, somebody I have deep respect for in the field, even though he's competitive to me right now.
Well, talk about that. So you started FARAPULSE. How did you get Boston Scientific engaged in that? I mean, I think it got some real high level buy-in from at the very top level. So you got someone's attention there.
Yeah. So, you know, it all seemed pretty innocent to me at the time. Literally the first time. So I built the first generator because I couldn't afford to pay anyone. Mm-hmm. And so I soldered that thing together. I used parts from an old laser and I, you know, bought some parts off of DigiKey and put it together. And the first time I ever fired it off was in front of a huge team of biz dev guys from Boston Scientific. Wow. I had never successfully fired the whole thing, but I was naive and bold at the same time. And what had happened, and this is something I found out later, is that, you know, Mike Mahoney is a Hawkeye. He is an alumni of the University of Iowa, and somebody at Iowa had told him, "Hey, there's this crazy doctor doing this crazy thing. You guys should take a look at this." And he just told his team to come down and check it out. And they checked it out and they came back and said, you know, this is worth investing in. And they invested. If it wasn't for their, they invested as an angel investment, you know, and so I think at the time I had started the company, I had made arrangements from the university to license the IP. And, you know, I had a pitch out there and business plan competitions. And we had looked at the state of Iowa for finance, you know, support. And there were a number of, you know, areas and some local investment, but we're talking about $200,000 of investment maybe. And then all of a sudden Boston came in and they made a major investment at that time. I don't remember if the quantum was published. That's my only hesitation. I don't want to give away things that I have a NDA to not disclose, but everyone knew that. And so, and it grew from there. So that's probably why it was Boston, but you got to give Mike Mahoney credit. Let's take a look at the current environment, that ecosystem of EP, and look how, you know, it's one thing to make some bets. It's another thing the way that they make so many bets that they're not afraid to fail. Whereas you get some big companies that just hate to buy stuff and they're just, you know, like, you know, I have a lot of respect for Mike and I do appreciate that he bought the company.
That's amazing. if he had gone to another Big Ten school, this could be an entirely different, different timeline.
I'd be a pig farmer by now.
We'll take a really quick break from our keynote interview with Dr. Steven Michelson to bring you the conclusion of our conversation with this episode's sponsor, Viant. I hope you enjoy. Excellent. Thank you so much, Anthony. So can you help our audience better understand how Viant works with medical device companies?
Absolutely. So our experts at Viant work as an extension to our partners. And that's really what we see. You know, our experts are their experts. Many of the innovators in this space need to pivot quickly during development to ensure their tools fit seamlessly into physician workflows. And that need for agility is something where, you know, Viant's experts really deeply understand this area. So our design and development team provides early stage design input, rapid prototyping, iterative testing, so customers can really refine their catheter designs for performance, manufacturability, and still keep those tight timelines that everybody has. So Viant's in-house technical expertise in things like polymer extrusion, injection molding, micromolding, automated solutions, and complex assembly that we have at both of our design and development facilities are really a powerful tool, and it allows for that quick turn development, especially in these catheter systems. So once the design is locked and the product is ready for market launch, we then leverage our global manufacturing network of these end-to-end capabilities to best fit partners' program needs.
I've seen some exciting moves coming from Viant. Do you have any news that you can share with us?
Absolutely. So we here at Viant really are investing in interventional therapies and complex interventional systems. So we've invested in capabilities that we really feel like matter the most for our partners. One of the biggest moves we've made is the expansion of our Costa Rica operations. We've got two new buildings on our campus. We've added about 21,000 square feet, which significantly increases our capacity for things like complex catheter assemblies. So investing in that type of capability really ensures that we can support our customers' needs as they move from feasibility to pivotal trials and on to commercial launch, and really make sure that with that progress, they have the scalability and the quality that they need. So another key differentiator is in our Collegeville, Pennsylvania site. So there we bring deep expertise in nitinol tubing, forming, drawing, and processing. So this is a critical capability for so many interventional products like stents and other structural heart products that require shape memory, fatigue resistance. And those are just a couple examples where we are proactively investing in what matters most to our med tech partners.
One of the reasons I really wanted to sit down with you today, Anthony, is to get your insights into what the future looks like. So how do you see the industry changing in the future?
Yeah, for me, what I'm seeing from my seat is across clinical markets, we're really seeing a continued demand for smart interventional technologies that improve outcomes, reduce procedure times, and really integrate seamlessly with physician workflows. Devices will become more sophisticated, requiring complex material constructions, miniaturization, which typically includes systems that require intricate embedded electronics as well. So at Viant, we're preparing for that future by investing in those state-of-the-art manufacturing technologies like micromolding, automated advanced solutions, and really continuing to grow our capacity so we can meet not only the technological, but the scale needs that our customers have. So, I mean, in the end, our goal is to really help these innovators bring medical miracles to the market faster with, you know, that quality and reliability that the patients and physicians deserve.
Fantastic, Anthony. Thank you so much. Anthony Meissner, General Manager, Design and Development for Viant Medical. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Kayleen. This has been great. You know, phenomenal conversation, and thanks for letting me be here.
And for our audience, to learn more about why Viant is in it for life, please visit their website at viantmedical.com. That's viantmedical.com. And thank you again.
So we'll fast forward through the acquisition and to the point that Farapulse, you know, is a market leader and a really high performer, obviously, for Boston Scientific. You are now with you've started another company, Field Medical. Talk quickly though about the time in between after you left Farapulse. You were at Acuitas, did you know you had another company in you? What were those years in between the sale and today? For you.
Oh, I literally recognized in those days that I was not in any position to run a med tech startup. I didn't have the business background. I didn't think of my prior experience as a rock star as being the CV you needed to run a med tech. But I recognized, the challenges of fundraising, the challenges of putting together a team to get all that organizational effort needed to make sure that you're making the right decisions and negotiating on the right level. Like I wasn't that guy then. And I knew that I had that gap in my skill set. So what I did is I just went out and hired a guy to replace me, Alan Zingler. Mm-hmm. And, you know, brought him on and, you know, and he was able to get it over the finish line. So I think like I did, I probably made a good choice there. Yeah. But the, I knew that I wasn't that guy at that moment. Like, and you, one of the things you have to do in a startup is really recognize where the skill sets are so that you have the right team at the right time for the right stage of development. Mm-hmm. Because these startups, they evolve so quickly and, you know, there are different skill sets needed for every step. But the, at that time that that wasn't me. I knew that. You know, I really wanted to see it get over the finish line. I had a lot of ideas. What I did is I stepped down. I focus on practicing because Lord knows I just spent 18 years getting the privileges to do so. And I started doing a lot of research in the area of pulse field. I didn't publish anything. I kept all that knowledge. And so I started really trying to understand, you know, now that we know it works, how do you optimize it? And then the next phase, I did a lot of early translational consulting for a lot of startups, going international and doing cases and working at, you know, presenting data and stuff to the FDA for other companies and, you know, helping out a number of great, great little, you know, startups. Some of them succeeded, some of them did not. I started getting a lot of calls to help other companies develop their pulse field programs. You know, some of them were really big international companies, but some of them were a lot smaller, and one of them was Acutus. So I joined Acutus for 3 years, helped them kind of dabble as an executive. And the my motivation to join Acutus was the opportunity to be put in a position of you know, an executive at a multinational med tech company. Mm-hmm. And learn a little bit more about the ins and outs about, you know, the cost of engineering, the stages of development and how to, you know, at commercialization and the pitfalls and things. When I joined, you know, they had just done an IPO, I don't have to go into the history too much, but 2 years later, there is, you know, that they still didn't, you know, we didn't have a therapy product in the market, mm-hmm. You know, for a lot of reasons, but it was pretty clear that that path, of developing a standalone novel PFA program for them, which was, you know, there's some interesting engineering constraints to do that for them. It was no longer a reality. And I talked to the leadership of the company and I said, look, I'm going to move and start my own company. Mm-hmm. I see the opportunity for a focal catheter and especially a catheter that's going to go after ventricular tachycardia. That is the frontier. That's the unmet need, the opportunity. And they were in alignment with that. And I got out in July of 22. And immediately started Field Medical and started investing in, a lot of finite element modeling, industrial design, and putting the strategy together. 6 months later, we had our first outside investment. You know, I basically, because of the winnings from Farapulse, I was able to take those, some of those earnings and fold them into this new company. And the freedom that bought me to be able to explore this idea in a very serious way was great. And that's in a long-winded and mm-hmm. circuitous path was, you know, the difference between 2016 and 2022. That's what occurred.
Did the time at Acutus give you sort of your kind of MBA experience being at a company and give you the confidence to think I can next time yes. I'd like to do this myself? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, 100%. Every yep. quarter I was signing off on the finances. I was looking at the organization and deep experience on that level helped with a little bit of the M&A activities and met a lot of people, networked with a lot of very key people. I had a lot of experience with all the other startups as well, but that is probably the closest thing to an MBA I would ever get is that experience.
So let's talk about Field Medical now. So what is the opportunity here? You're dealing with a similar device, right? But you're just going after a different part of the anatomy of the heart.
Yeah. So, you know, isn't that funny how the FDA makes you like do a different clinical trial for persistent AFib and AAO and paroxysmal AFib? Like you're kind of doing the same thing with the same tool in the same place, the heart, yet those are different indications and different trials. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be that catheter ablation was soft tissue ablation, and it still is that in Europe most for the most part. And so, yeah, so you can use, you know, the energy at the end of a long tube to treat whatever you like. But something that's different about AFib, the AFib space is very crowded right now. Lots of great second generation PFA. I recognize that. But all that technology in the atria that we know, and almost everything that's been developed has been developed primarily to work in the atria, has left us with the technical challenges of the ventricle as being a secondary thought. And there's only two catheters on earth that are approved to be used in the ventricle by the FDA, Tactiflex and the SmartTouch. Those were not developed for that use, but another use. And so what was clear to me is that you needed different technology than was being developed to be really good at treating things. The atria is thin, so getting full transmurality in the atria is easy. But the ventricle's thick, you know, it's a centimeter of penetration that you need to get, for most applications if transmurality is required. The atria doesn't move very much by comparison. The ventricle moves centimeters. The ventricle is, so the geometry of getting a catheter out there and having it perform well is actually more challenging because you have to make a 180 degree turn no matter what you do before you even start moving. Right. And so there is a lot of technical challenges for working in the ventricle that where PFA is actually an ideal energy source. Proximity ablation, when you have very complex geometry of trabeculated inside of the heart, like that complex geometry makes it hard for a radiofrequency catheter to effectively create lesions. And this is one of the reasons why VT ablation, despite the fact that it has been proven to be the most effective therapy that we know of for treating VT, way of more effective than drugs. It is not widely available because the average VT ablation is 4 hours. And so when I looked at that, I said, look, I think I can solve that problem. What I need is a generator that does some pretty fancy stuff, but I know what it needs to do. And I need a new type of catheter that has a new type of electrode. I was not allowed to play with any of those variables at Acuitas, but because the constraints were, here's a catheter, make it work. You can't play with that. We already have that. And here I got to say, look, it's a clean slate. Let's just do what's needed. And the ventricular ablation space, people think it's not a very big market, but ventricular ablation, PVCs, VT, VF, all that stuff, that is half the size of AFib. Wow. All right. But it's really unpenetrated. And it very much like AFib was in 2010. AFib ablation was on average 4 hours. Guess what? Today, average FARAPULSE case is sub 1 hour. It's reliably so. That means that you can do 5 cases in a day, no problem. In the old days, you would be struggling with your cath lab manager to be able to book more than one case in a day in many labs. And to do 2 in a day was like you were a rock star. Mm-hmm. And VT ablation today, on average, is around 4 hours. It's a complex ablation, very much like AFib used to be, but we see visibility on a way that we can get these reliable, safe procedures, and that's where I see the opportunity. And I don't think I'm the only one anymore. I for a while, I thought I was alone there, but it's pretty clear that we're not the only people out there trying to go after the VT market now with PFA. And so we just have a little bit of a head start.
Do some of those other entities include those that are focused on the atria? Or is it just a matter of adjusting the devices they have to make that adjustment? Or is everyone going to have to start with a clean slate like you did?
Well, so I would highly recommend you start with a clean slate if you want to be good. But the business need here, if you have a technology that works pretty good in the atria, it's cheaper if you can get it to, does it work good enough in the ventricle, right? And that's what RF ablation catheters are. They work good for atria and they are the only option for the ventricle, but they're not optimized for it. Mm-hmm. Let's take some examples. Arga MedTech, it's a cryo company. They've been around for a while making this amazing cryo ablation platform, super cold cryo. And all of a sudden the PFA wave hits them and they have to pivot. And so a lot of these companies like them, like Affera, CardioFocus, for mm-hmm. example. Literally, CardioFocus is a laser balloon, but now they're a PFA program too. And so that pivot is, that's what you're going to see initially, and that's going to be strong. All the big companies have their own internal program to take their focal RF catheters and turn them into dual energy source catheters. Mm-hmm. But the reality is to get something that reaches as deep and have good workflow and works well in that environment, you probably, or at least I believe, and for my investors' sake, I hope I'm right. There's a huge advantage of starting with the clean slate and designing something for the purposes of being good at treating that problem. And I think, my beautiful team of engineers and partners in this field have come up with a recipe that I stand behind.
And you've got a good bit of a head start, I think, on the clinical trial side. Have you initiated your Veritas pivotal trial yet? Where are you with
no? So I'm anticipating this time next year I'll be able to say yes. Mm-hmm. Where we are is at 18 months we did our first in man. We're at and a year and a half later we are 60 some odd patients in. We're about to present this initial data, and the thing that we're finalizing is the commercial the foundation of the commercial generator itself. That's almost done, and then we're applying for an IDE trial. I'm hoping that's going to occur sometime in Q1 Q2 of 26. Mm-hmm. Since we're in the TAP program, there's a lot of steps that get quite expedited, and I have to say this is the first time in my whole career where I have felt truly that the FDA is collaborative. I mean, it's so collaborative, and I look forward to calls with the FDA. It's just great. Some great people there that are just that really believe that we need a new therapy for VT, the Veritas trial is probably coming. I would think in Q2, Q3 at the latest of 26, and there is a opportunity to bring it in, but I'm not going to make any promises there.
And what are some lessons you took away from Farapulse? When we talked before I pressed record, you're looking more at the exterior design. You're trying to do things a bit differently. What are some things you're doing differently with Field?
One of the things I learned from Farapulse, which I think is an important general lesson, is don't be afraid to pivot. Mm-hmm. And this is a lesson I learned from Alan. Physicians get training. This is literally an Alan Zingler piece of knowledge that I pulled that he very kindly gave to me. Physicians, after they finish their training, have a very hard time adopting new procedures. Mm-hmm. And so what you really want is a product that they already know how to use, but works better. Mm-hmm. And that's what Farapulse ended up being in the end. Everyone knows how to use a catheter. The workflow of Farapulse is basically cryoballoon, but works better than cryoballoon. And taking advantage of that, improve and the enemy of perfect is, the enemy of good is perfect or whatever. Mm-hmm. Oh, God. Not exactly
perfect
philosopher
be the enemy
today.
Of good, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, gosh. Not so eloquent. But, yeah, so those are the things I took away from Farapulse was, really you know, sit down and reflect and be critical of your own decisions. And that allowed, you know, and so when we approached this program, you know, we've had to pivot a number of times. And I think that's been really beneficial. And, you know, and also, you know, it has to be not just incrementally better. The things have to be, you know, a large leap forward. Mm-hmm. And so that has helped us to be pretty brave in building, you know, in a short period of time. This is a contact force, 3D, you know, vector forces is capable with this catheter. It's got a magnetic sensor. It's got, you know, it's a nice form factor, et cetera. But the generator is also super versatile. And yeah, if we wanted to do biphasics, we could. But, you know, in general, I think, you know, there are a lot of different recipes that we're playing with. And it's the versatility of the system that's, you know, allowed us to be able to play with some new concepts that, you know, I couldn't have done in the past. And you know, and so the company really brings some interesting knowledge, you know, to the forefront. One of the other things that we've done is we've also, like, even though we're a VT company, there's been a huge amount of interest of, well, if it works in the ventricle, how does it work in the atria? And we did a small series. I think we've done 30, 35 patients, in the atria. And yeah, when you have a tool like this, it's incredibly fast. The entire ablation takes less than a second. It's 140 milliseconds.
Wow. Like,
it's literally you fire, move, fire, move, fire, move. It's fast. It's just, and it's, you know, it's a really big footprint. And the comments that we get, you know, from physicians, you know, there's one conversation at one of these meetings where they said, well, that's like having instantaneous ablation, which I was flattered. I wish I had come up with that myself. But the, I think actually it's probably Vivek Reddy who said that. But the other thing was that, when you have a tool is this powerful, then the question is, well, is it too powerful? And that's a great question that, you know, for the first time we have an ablation tool that, you know, that maybe we have to turn it down. And that's easy to do. Uh-huh. Just try turning something else up, you know, then that's when you get all the trouble. But yeah, so it's very fast, you know, and hopefully it's going to, so far the signal is, it looks pretty safe. And you know, it's a very small sample, but boy, you know, it's an exciting time for the company, which is, you know, on the verge of being able to publish some meaningful follow-up, a 6-month follow-up on both our cohorts in the ventricle and our cohorts in the atria.
And you had held up the generator for me. It looks like an Xbox or something. It's got a kind of a sleek design.
Yeah, it's pretty slick. It is slick. You know, I'm pretty happy with the industrial design. You know, one of the things I've learned with my years of playing with med tech companies is that it's an expensive hobby, and B, if you don't have a vision for the final form factor when you start the engineering, I mean, at least in, you know, electrosurgical boxes, you're going to end up with your prototype is going to be a big, ugly box, and your commercial tool is going to be a big, shiny box. But it ain't going to, the form factor doesn't change much. And so you don't get to really take advantage of the user experience that feeds back largely. Like, how do you actually get a system into a cath lab that integrates well? And often those design inputs don't enter the dialogue until much later. And rightfully so. I mean, the goal is to make a minimum viable prototype, and then next thing show feasibility, and then next thing raise money. And, like, you know, and so there's these steps that you take, and industrial design doesn't usually get onto the radar till you're often in your pivotal trial. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to start with the vision so I could share it with the engineers and said, this, you know, we're going to invest in the industrial design early on, and all the tools you're working on right now need to somehow fit into this in the end. And that has resulted in a generator that is substantially smaller than you know, we thought possible. We're operating at voltages greater than 10,000 volts, where we have the ability to switch things, you know, on the nanosecond scale between different electrodes. It's a crazy piece of technology that wasn't even possible 5 years ago. Like, I mean, maybe five, but certainly not 10 years ago. Like, the type of technology that's been developed for military applications and electric vehicles, for high voltage switching and all these interesting capacitor advances and stuff, that stuff, if you take it and now apply it to your medical problems, boy, you know, we're living in the future. I feel like, you know, this thing kind of looks like really something that's science fiction, and it's beautiful, but it was really designed with the concept of how do you get something new in the cath lab that doesn't interfere with the workflow that mm-hmm. nurses can use, that really is optimized for several positions, because not everyone practices the same. And so that's where we kind of started the process with the industrial design and did the engineering second.
Final question. You mentioned that you've stopped practicing, at least for now. What led to that decision, and how much do you miss it?
I miss it a lot. Taking care of patients is definitely the most rewarding part of being a doctor. I don't want to toot my horn, but I feel like I'm relatively good at it. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoy the process of doing ablation and diagnosis and, you know, this suturing and, seeing patients and talking to them. But, and I've been able to practice in a kind of a beautiful way where I've been able to spend a lot of time with very few patients, because I was usually doing 5 or 10 patients a month, mm-hmm. not enough to make a living, but enough to keep my skills while I did early med tech development for a lot of people. And my position at Scripps, you know, what was happening is, as the demands of this company, which I've fully invested my life into, we're getting higher and higher. It started becoming clear to me that I would have to travel and I wouldn't even be able to discharge my own patients. And if there was, and it would be hard for my patients to communicate to me. And then all of a sudden we got really big investment, and mm-hmm. I started thinking, well, gosh, if I was investing in the company, would I want the CEO to be a part-time CEO?
Yeah.
Or do I want a fully dedicated person who's focused on success for the company? And then it was pretty clear. It was time to give up my privileges. I'm still a board certified EP doctor, but, and that was, my last cases, ironically, were using a Farah, which was, by the way, pretty, I was all, damn, I'm gonna have to work pretty hard to beat this shit. it was really good to be able to use my competitor's technology as a physician, and kind of get the user in experience and be able to apply it directly to development. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think that's incredibly valuable. But at this time, at this stage of the company, the right thing to do was to be a full-time CEO.
Well, I'm glad you're back at it. I'm really grateful you shared your story here. I love the energy, the enthusiasm, and the vision. So thanks for being
on the podcast. Well, Tom, we'll see you. Are you going to be in Philadelphia for the VT symposium?
I wasn't planning to, but if that's an invitation, I'll come on down.
Oh my God, we're gonna have a little presence at that event, and we're gonna have a little party. I'll invite you to it. It'll be I think we're renting out the Mueller Museum to sit down and kind of do a little presentation on VT and try to raise awareness on VT ablation.
Very cool. Well, right. If it's anything like NASB used to be, then I guess then I'll have to come.
Oh my God, I don't think we're not going that far.
Thanks for being on the podcast, Steve.
All right, bye bye. Take care.
Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of Device Talks Weekly. We really do hope you'll join us at Device Talks West on October 15th and 16th. Our next podcast will come out next Friday. It'll be recorded on stage at the conference. So look for that on Friday. I hope you look forward to it. Also, please subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network and connect with us on LinkedIn. But really, we really just want to see you in person. So go to west.devicetalks.com. Use the code at DTWeekly25. If you have any questions about getting in, shoot me a DM. I'll be working all weekend and be happy to do what I can to make sure you get into the room. But it's going to be a great event, bigger than last year, and lots of great keynotes. Go to west.devicetalks.com to check it out. Lots of great panels as well, and can't wait to see you there. All right, folks. Thanks for listening to this episode of Device Talks Weekly, and we'll see you in Santa Clara.